This is CliffCentral.com.
Is present. And first, should we start with an apology, Jonathan? Because our immune systems have been expropriated without compensation.
Yes.
And we have been infected with disgusting viruses that make me sound like I've just
Well, even
out
worse
of,
than usual,
that,
actually.
That I've just come out of a gulag after 12 years. So I do apologize if I sound atrocious for this hour podcast. But I'm here, aren't I? Fuck, so give me a bit of slack.
Yeah, I'm also just getting over something. I don't know what the hell that was, but a bit of a cough as well, so, and a bit of a gruff voice, so apologies. But let's get on with the content of the show. You have a whole list there. I have no idea what we're discussing. But
it's 3 bullet points, for goodness sake.
But let's get on with it. Let's talk. This is our last show for the year, we should probably tell people.
Right. So we had a guest booked, and she sort of pulled out. Well, she just didn't respond. But we hope to have her back. She's a very important journalist, and we will hopefully have her sometime in the new year. I saw she just released a story last night on a Sunday. So we'll give her charitable. We'll be charitable. We assume she's busy.
Yeah, busy lady.
And we'll hopefully get her back. So, unfortunately, people of the internet, this will be our last show for the year, not ever, just for the year. And I must admit, it's been a phenomenal year for the podcast, but not for the country. And we're going to talk about the country, not the podcast.
Yeah, if you sort of plot South Africa's growth path against the Renegade Report, it's like an inverse graph of each other. So,
but not in terms of money, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so... what do you want to talk about?
Right. So I think there was a case last week where Jeremy Nell, who we all know, the cartoonist, was fired from Outer, whom we know as well, for so-called being racist. Now, this
some context, though. He didn't do tons of work for them, and he hadn't done work for a couple of months for them.
Yeah, but
it wasn't like this massive...
That's beside the point, really. The fundamental thing is he got fired for purportedly being a racist.
Mm.
Now... This is one small example, but it's indicative of a greater ideological wind that's running through the country at the moment, where, for me, this is the NDI at work. So you have people who go through social media posts, they go through Facebook posts, they select a target. This case, Germ, they say, okay, who does Germ work for? Who does he work with? Okay, which of his clients really care about the image in the public? Oh, civil activism, Outer will care deeply about the image, right? They are corruption busters, so they don't want to be seen to be associated with right-wingers, supposedly. So you got these people, they tag Outer in tweets with Facebook posts that Germ made that are out of context, of course. Then they tell their mate at The Citizen to write an article about why Outer is being slammed for using a right-wing cartoonist. That is the literal headline, as if there's something wrong with being right-wing. Outer reads the article. They say, oh, we are not for racism, so we won't work with Germ anymore. Now, someone loses their job and income based on two tweets and an literally like fake news article. And this is a very clear strategy that's being used by, I would argue, and I think I know who it is.
Well, there's allegedly a group of people.
Right, allegedly. And allegedly the head of that group of people recently passed away. But Gillian Schutter is involved. You know, that woman that killed that black man by throwing him off a waterfall.
Allegedly.
Well, the NPA is so useless they don't, you know, bring it to court to face that. But she's one of them. So it's shadowy figures trying to destroy people that are on the opposite side of the political spectrum.
Instead of just having an open discussion and argument with them.
Right. Mm. It's accusation of racism. It's been happening for 20 years. And then once you be called a racist, that's what you are for the rest of time. The most interesting part is Outer does so, fires Germ, without a hint of an investigation. Like, not even. Yeah.
It's from what I saw, and I wasn't following too deeply, but as far as I could tell, it was one account which they had responded to, which is essentially an anonymous account, and there's no name linked to that account. It does have, I think it's in the few hundred followers, so it's not like completely bot, but it's a relatively small anonymous account posted to Arta and said, why do you work with and hire and associate with this guy who's a racist, basically? And Arta then responds and goes, well, we don't, and we no longer work with him. We've decided to parted ways.
Right. And the CEO of Arta, Wayne, was on the show a few weeks ago.
Yeah, good podcast.
Right. And he's a good chap. I think he does good work. But I spoke about the NDR, and he didn't get it.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought to myself, oh, Wayne, Arta is ripe for infiltration. And the NDR is important in this discussion, because something like Arta is an institution with a lot of resources. They make, I assume, a few million rand a month in donations. They do good fights. They fight against ETOL, corruption, and all that. If you are the ANC, or if you are a sort of a leftist, you would look at such an institution and be like, that's a good resource pool to draw from. I mean, you can still be a leftist and say ETOLs are wrong. And you can still be a leftist and say corruption is terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not an ideological battle. It's a policy battle. It's a legal battle at the end of the day. But you can still use the institution of Arta to fight corruption, but you can use it as resources for your view, or for your mates, or for institutions you want to fund through it. So if you, and that's the key thing, if you don't understand the National Democratic Revolution and the way they infiltrate and take over institutions, this is a key way to do it. And I'm not saying Alta is being infiltrated or not, but I just think the greater battle of ideas, one must be cognizant of the fact that the things that you fund as ordinary members of the public could be working against you in the long term.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point around, we've discussed this National Democratic Revolution on many shows, and I constantly find myself up against people not understanding the entire concept. It's kind of as if even smart people that we've had on the show who are on our ideological side of the issues, some people are they're in the Kruger Park and they're looking at the cheetah, and it's 400 meters away, and they're looking at it with their eyes. And then there's some people who are like, no, I can use binoculars to do this, and they're looking at the cheetah with binoculars. And then there's some people who are actually seeing the entire picture through a drone. So they see the cheetah and they see the prey that the cheetah's going after. And then there's some people who are basically looking at it through a satellite, and they're seeing the cheetah, the prey, but then they're also seeing the hyenas that are in the background waiting for the cheetah to take the prey down and steal the prey. And so this is the problem, is that the NDR is the satellite picture. If you understand that the greater goal of all these people, and in multiple different factions, and people that were for Jacob Zuma, people that were against Jacob Zuma, people that are in the BLF, people that are in the EFF, people that are in the DA, you don't have to, if you just see those people as in each of those parties doing their little things, you're just looking at the cheetah with your eyes. Yeah. If you understand that these people might go about things different ways, but their ultimate end goal, their greater picture for life and the way things should work in this country and in the world, in fact, is that satellite picture. It's that National Democratic Revolution that ultimately applies to everything.
Yeah.
And the more people that understand that and start analyzing scenarios and analyzing current events through that picture. It's the same as if you want to look internationally, if you understand the whole globalism idea and the problems that globalism potentially presents, it's the same concept. It's like, is an EU army a good idea? Well, if you're just looking at the cheetah with your eyes, seems like a good idea. It seems like a more peacekeeping, you know, but good idea.
But you only talk about the army.
But if you understand like a global army for that continent, which is Hitler's idea actually, then you might start seeing some problems. And so I just think, and I hope we've been successful in this on the show through the year to open people's eyes to a bit more of what's happening in the background.
Right, right. If South Africa is a chess board, we are a pawn. I'm a pawn, Jonathan's a pawn, you might be a pawn on it. And we think we have sort of independence in what we're doing. Oh, you know, EWC is coming up. We are going to fight it, and we are going to court. And EWC is maybe like 10% of the whole strategy.
Yeah,
you're moving one block at a time, where your enemy has already seen 50 blocks ahead of you.
Hmm.
But what they're doing, so they say, okay, EWC is the way to go. You fight them, you put them back one block on the chessboard, but then they'll take three blocks to the side and 20 blocks forward on something else. Oh, the NHI. Or the mining charter, or no, BEE must come in as well.
Well, before the show, we're discussing, you know, who funds BLF? Because the Guptas are gone, right?
Supposedly.
The Guptas are gone, supposedly. Fine. Let's assume they're not really pumping tons of cash into the country anymore because they've got their value out of the country. They're right. Unlikely to get too much more out of it, certainly not in billions.
I mean, as parasites, they're full.
Yes. And they're living a good life, apparently, in Dubai. People see them at parties and living the high life. So who's funding a tiny little party called Black Land First, spewing stuff like Andile seemingly did, I think, this past weekend, where he mentioned that he asked his supporters to kill white people, kill their women, kill their children, kill their dogs. And who's funding that? Who's paying for him to stand on a stage? Who's paying for the PA system? That's a sort of 10,000 rand setup. Who gives them the money?
Yeah.
Now, if you want to be a little bit conspiratorial, but it's not out of the realm of possibility, maybe the ANC is funding that. ANC funds that, and they fund someone who's so radical, so far left radical, that when the ANC comes out and proposes a normal leftist kind of view, the average person who's heard this guy talking about killing people goes, you know what? He says he wants to kill me and take the land. You guys just want to take the land. I tell you what, that sounds very reasonable. Take the land.
Ramaphosa must give a big mandate to Ramaphosa.
And in essence, the Jacob Zuma presidency did that for Ramaphosa. We saw that with Ramaphosa this year.
Yeah.
We saw that the birth that was given, the white birth that was given to Ramaphosa, I don't think any president really in history.
Or
I mean,
since Mandela,
even Mnangagwa in Zimbabwe after Mugabe hasn't been given that kind of wide berth. People have been not so trusting of him and his history and whatever. Cyril Ramaphosa was no different in his sort of relationship to Zuma and how close he was to that government and how close he was to the levers of power that plunged us into what now everyone suddenly recognizes as 10 years of sort of darkness. And Ramaphosa gets given this wide berth. He's going to do amazing things. And I'm still waiting. And I keep getting told by people, you know, no, he's, you know, 4D chess. It's all 4D chess, 4D underwater, upside down hippo chess. But it just doesn't seem to be getting anywhere.
No. I think the Zondo Commission actually has hurt him in the long run more than anything else. But, I mean, don't assume for one second that the EFF, BLF, and ANC are connected, because of course they are in some way or another.
Mm.
Okay, the media loves to say, oh, Mazzotti paid for this, and Mazzotti, you know, Julius is living in Mazzotti's mansion. Mazzotti is probably like best friends with many members of the ANC, and it's you can use Mazzotti as a distraction from what is actually happening with the relationship between the EFF and the ANC.
Sure, I mean if Julius Malema is so wild and so radical and so not related to the ANC, why when they have that global citizen conference concert, and they invite all these people from all over the world, and Patrice Motsepe, who's a basically a long-standing ANC supporter.
He's a president's brother-in-law, isn't he?
Well, yes, and for other reasons as well. Cyril is there as well. And guess who's there as well? Julius, the 6% politician.
Backstage.
Oh,
VIP.
Was Musi Maimane there? No, he wasn't. You know, these are things you just kind of got to open your eyes and start seeing the realities of really the actual relationships and how people leverage their network to benefit their ultimate goals. And as I say, what the global ultimate goal is, which is the NDR.
Yeah, well, but for a South African context, do not underestimate the strategy and the ideology of power. The DA does the same, right? I'm sure the DA funds some things that sort of can oppose them in some way to make themselves seem moderate compared to that. This is all good strategy and
politics.
As much as the ANC is incompetent in various things, they are very good at strategy. They must not be underestimated in this regard. So we went from outer and germed like larger theory, but it's very important that if you're not aware, you're just a leaf in a hurricane of ideological battles, right? You must become that firmly planted tree and understand you're being treated as a pawn and you can't fight it. You can do so by, you know, giving us some money. So if you go to patreon.com/, I'm joking.
Do you want to talk about the Patreon thing, actually? Because that's becoming a bit controversial.
We didn't talk about it before, actually, yes. So Patreon banned Milo Yiannopoulos first after 24 hours.
Milo, and was Lauren Southern before?
Yeah, but she was banned a long time.
Yes, Lauren Southern was about a year ago.
Right.
I just want to talk about the Lauren Southern case because I think it's interesting. I'm not a big fan of Lauren Southern.
No, me neither.
For a number of reasons, I think she's more provocative than content full. but she was banned because of what Patreon called manifest observable behavior, which
I think we watched the same YouTube video yesterday.
No, I haven't watched anything.
So I got another card latest.
Oh, okay.
It's very good.
So if that's a good video, then you should go watch it. But basically, her manifest observable behavior, which was their way of saying the way you behave in the world, was that she was on a ship, a boat, actually, and there was a supposed migrant ship that was bringing migrants, and they stood in the path of the migrant ship, which caused a safety issue, and there was claims that, you know, there were sick women and children on the ship, and Lauren Southern was basically standing in the way of these people's welfare. And so they Patreon threw her on that basis. A year later, what's quite interesting about that is those ships have been stopped from moving because there's a lot of suspicions and allegations of child trafficking and people trafficking and drug trafficking. There's a whole bunch of nefarious things that have been linked to all of that. So it kind of changes the picture on what Lauren Southern was banned for, and it makes it a lot less legitimate, in my opinion. Now they go after Milo Yiannopoulos, who, as far as I understand, is now ruined. I mean, as far as I understand, he's pretty much
$4 million. But they say he was associated with the Proud Boys, which the FBI said are a local terrorist group.
Except the FBI never said that.
Exactly.
Yes. So the newspapers reported that the Proud Boys were an FBI. The FBI had them on their terrorist watch list.
Right.
Which is quite an indictment because, as far as I know, Antifa isn't fully on the FBI watch list yet. They are on certain state watch lists. But you know, that's quite a big thing. And as it happened, so they reported on it. They run with the lie. The lie gets repeated in multiple other publications which also run with the same lie. And as it happened, they were never on that watch list.
Right. So they banned Milo for something that's fake. And then Patreon on Saturday took out Sargon of Akkad's page. So Sargon of Akkad is a YouTuber from England.
Carl Benjamin.
His name is Carl Benjamin. I sort of like him. I find him a bit mellow, to be honest.
But he's very laid back. I mean, Carl Benjamin, really, he calls himself a classical liberal. I think he is pretty much a classical liberal.
But like in in the English sense.
Yeah, he really doesn't say anything like.
Yeah. So and they banned him. They banned him for him being on another person's live stream, calling Nazis white niggers.
Yes.
He says you're behaving like white niggers because and. The context of that is the way you talk about black people being the stereotype, the nigger stereotype, you're behaving exactly the same way that you stereotype black people, but you're white. So he did it to you know, infuriate Nazis. So he's getting banned for being on someone else's stream.
Not on Patreon either. It was never on their site.
Where his Patreon funds are not being used at all on someone else's stream. And he gets banned for racist language.
Yeah,
how that connects to Patreon, I have no idea, because it's not on Sargon's channel. It's not on his banned from Twitter. So it's not there. It's not on Sargon's Facebook page. It's on someone else's live stream, and he's infuriating. He's insulting Nazis, he gets banned for insulting Nazis.
Yeah,
proper real Nazis.
Because he used the N-word. But the issue is that the net now is becoming so wide on what you can, you know, the speech police. It's being entrenched. It's entrenched now in Patreon. We've seen it entrenched in Twitter. We've seen it entrenched in Facebook, Google as well. Apple CEO turns around a week ago and says they will not be allowing hate speech on their platform. Except we have no idea what hate speech is anymore, because when someone uses language to like mock Nazis, for example, that's hate speech. Really, the lines are so blurred. We see Kevin Hart not being able to host the Oscars because he said the word fag.
I think so. I don't know.
The word for cigarette, right? He said that 10 years ago on a tweet or something like that. So now he can't. And he's a comedian, guys. Like, for fuck's sake. I mean, he didn't even say it in, like, polite conversation. He made a joke. Okay, it isn't the funniest joke. Like, who cares? Like, Amy Schumer has an entire special, which isn't a joke. Like seriously. Like, and I might add that Amy Schumer has used the same words before. And isn't being deplatformed at the moment. This is the problem with when you allow people to decide what is hate speech and what isn't, is they will decide not based on any fixed criteria.
Yeah, no, there's no foundation for what they think is hate speech or not. So for us, Jonathan, this is the first time we're discussing it. We have to make a decision about Patreon.
Yeah,
sooner or later. I'm inclined to think we should get off that platform.
In time, personally. Yeah. We need time. To look at it.
We would love to hear what our listeners have to say. So if you have any suggestions, info@renegadereport.co.za. We appreciate what Patreon has done for us, but it's a principled stance. I'd rather lose money in the short term. Not that we make millions by any means. And all that money's going back into the podcast. Maybe use an alternative site or just have direct debit orders or PayPal or something like that. Because it's the same with the outer germ thing.
Mm.
We can get reported to Patreon for saying we said niggers 3 times in 5 minutes right now. And we can get reported for that, and Patreon will take down our page. Is that
there you go, leftists.
Yeah.
Go for it.
There you go. So if that is, to me, principle matters a lot here. So in the new year, we might look at alternative ways to get this podcast funded.
Yeah. Just a warning before you do go to Patreon, please do that, because you will Streisand effect this podcast overnight.
Don't
so.
Tell them the strategy. Jonathan, for fuck's sake, we can't be that honest on our podcast, especially when Nicholas Bauer is listening.
Yes.
Now he's not going to tweet about us at all.
Damn it.
You see what you've done.
Come on, Nick, come on the show, man. We still want you.
See what you've done. Want you. So it's the same principle as the outer germ thing, right?
Mm.
For except Patreon this time is the one that's doing the cancelling. So yes, quite a lot of time on freedom of speech. Another thing that I wanted to talk about is the global citizen thing, and then there was like a bit of a bit. There was like a
There was despicable violence.
An orgy of violence and rape and robbery after the fact. With respect to it, like, I don't think it's, I'm not laughing about it. I'm not trying to make a joke about it. But it points to a very particular thing I want to talk about, the what my friend calls the Lagosification of Joburg. So I think
I know which friend this is.
I've never been to Lagos, and I have no hope in hell I'm ever going there.
I have,
there.
Yes.
Oh, have you been there?
I have been to Lagos and to other places in Nigeria. Quite spectacular.
I'm sorry to hear that. My barber's Nigerian, and he had a shop there, yep. And he spent all his profits on bribes, generators, and bribes again. Like, he couldn't make a profit because something always fucked up.
I can fully imagine
that. And there was no contracts and there was nothing. So you came here and...
Incredibly entrepreneurial people. Absolutely. I have to... I mean, some of the things I saw...
220 million people in the country.
Yeah, some of the things I saw in Nigeria, just in terms of their free market enterprise.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable. And I think if you took the government away, if you could make that country into your anarchy...
Yeah.
I think it would be quite incredible because they will literally just like take... bricks and build like a store on the side of like the highway. Like, I'm not joking. Like, on the side of the highway.
On
a Sunday night, they are running that store till 11 o'clock in the evening.
Right.
Just unbelievable entrepreneurial spirit. But yes, Lagos is a very special place.
So just describe it. So as far as I'm aware, it is an absolute shithole. And then you got pockets of like sort of civilization. Like, you got pockets, like there's a mall... And there's houses. And everything's really expensive.
So firstly, I mean, just in Nigeria in general, and from what I understand, if you complete a building, you have to pay rates and taxes. Okay? This is in a few African countries I visited, apparently this is like the rule. But if the country's not complete, I mean, if the building's not complete, the country too, but if the building's not complete, then you don't pay the taxes. So you often see these buildings, some of them which are very nice, but like the top story of the building will just be like not plastered at all. Or like have no windows yet, or there'll be something like that that's going on, and you'll be like, "What's going on there?" And they'll just be like, "No, they haven't finished the building yet." So there's a lot of that. Sometimes there'll be really nice buildings next door to a plot that someone's like literally sticking up, like that church that collapsed in Nigeria that killed all those people. That you can kind of see the building is swaying, like it's not stable. I've never been in a country where I felt claustrophobic. Like, it's not a small country, but there are a lot of people, and you do feel like everyone is kind of on top of each other. It's such an odd kind of feeling. Obviously, it's quite hot there as well. It's very equatorial sort of temperatures,
sure.
Humid and all of that. And yeah, then, you know, all the stories you hear about traffic and the driving. I was the one trip I took there, I was on a sort of minibus type thing. And we were driving down the highway, and there were vehicles and bikes coming straight towards us on the same side of. I mean, it's a highway, but nobody gives a shit. So, you know, there's a lot of lawlessness in a lot of respects in that regard.
A lot of kidnappings of rich family.
Yeah.
Kids.
So the one trip I went on, I actually had an escort. So I was in that minibus on this particular trip, and in front of me, I had four guys in a Hilux. Four guys on the back of a Hilux and two guys in the front, and the four guys on the back were all carrying AKs because I went to do some training for an oil company, and that's what they do to make sure you don't get kidnapped.
So the whole point of this is that my friend, and I'm starting to believe this as well, is that South Africa will turn out to be that way within the next 20 to 30 years. It sort of fits into the enclave system that Franz Crenier talks about.
Yeah.
But like the big cities have no hope in hell of actually solving any issues. So people would do it on their own accord, but they'll always be hamstrung by regulations or by gangsters or by something like that. So Heelbrow is actually sort of the model to follow. You can still live there, but it's not nice. It's quite dangerous. And then you have all these other, on the outskirts, the suburbs will just become closed off.
It's the anarchy where the guy with the biggest gun is actually the dictator, right?
In some ways, except in the suburbs, if you've got money, you can live there.
Yes.
And then you'll just block yourself off from the rest of the city, essentially.
Yes, yes.
You'll be worried about kidnappings of your children by gangsters who want ransom. Shops will still sell things, but it's going to be a lot more expensive, a lot more scarce resources, like fresh bread.
See that in Angola, actually.
Right. And he predicts that Joburg, Durban, Bloemfontein, the big cities of South Africa will somehow turn out like this, because the problems are so vast that no matter if you're the DA with the best of intentions, you have no hope in hell of actually solving them, because water is a nightmare. There's no secure provider of electricity,
yeah,
things like that. So people will break the law and get.
But enforcing rule of law is probably where it all starts,
that's
right?
That's the key aspect, and even that is shocking.
Yeah, well,
in Joburg specifically.
I mean, you know, you mentioned Hillbrow, and I've worked there, and I have very close family who work there in medical positions, and it is very lawless, and you know, it's violent as well. It's certainly run by certain groups in different areas. The police are definitely scared to go into some places.
Or part of the groups, right? Part of the gangs.
Yeah. It's not an unforeseeable,
right,
possibility.
And then, so for people like us, so for the middle class, you will see Waterfall Estate becoming like a city in and of itself.
Yeah.
It's got walls, it's got security, it's got drones, it's got fucking motion detection cameras. Yeah. And inside you got your mall, your ice rink, and your school and your hospital. And as a you live like the expat life, as if you were in Angola, but you're living in the country of your birth, South Africa, as a middle class.
And your
citizen.
Friend thinks this is gonna happen how quickly?
Oh, geez, at this rate, between 15 to 20 years.
I don't think that's an unreasonable prediction.
No.
What do you think the way we fix that is? Like, prevent that?
Do I want to prevent it, though? That's the key. Well, yeah. I don't think I do want to prevent it.
The anarchists wouldn't want to prevent that necessarily.
No, not really. I don't foresee any potential future where there's the will, the money, and the manpower to fix it. I think it's de facto going to happen. That's already happening, Jonathan. I went to go see a new development just for interest's sake. So you buy a property for 3 million rand, you buy the land.
Okay.
You can choose three styles of houses. A barn, a fucking, I don't know what. You know, this modern
country house.
Yeah, this modern architecture is bullshit, right? Zone 1 was sold out in 12 days. And
how many houses is that, do you think, or plots?
Zone 1 was a few hundred houses.
Sure.
A few hundred
at three, houses. At 3 million rand
just
each.
For the land. Just for the land.
Yeah.
Not for the house.
Yeah, and
the
a house is
another
probably
2 million, 3 million.
Easy, yeah.
And you need about 20% deposit cash up front to secure it.
Sure.
Phase 2 is coming up
now. Around.
It's 80% sold out already. This is happening before our eyes. Segregation is happening before our eyes because people are voluntarily doing so. Stain City, Dainfern, Waterfall Estate, things like that. These are responding to market forces. People want a sense of community and a sense of safety, and the market is providing for them. And those little enclaves, which is what they will become sooner or later, you will live there, you'll live very well, you'll trade, you'll make money, you'll need a secured escort to the airport, you know, so you can go visit your cousin in Germany. You'll need a private escort when you go outside of those enclaves. So I foresee these enclaves taking on a lot more control of services. They'll have their own generators, their own solar farms, their own water treatment plants, their own schools, own hospitals, and I think it's wonderful. So all the, you know.
You think it's wonderful. I think it's terrible.
No, I think it's wonderful because I will hopefully live in one of those things sooner or later. But and that goes back to the NDR. They want Eskom to stay as is. They want SAA to stay as is. They want Transnet to stay. No retrenchments in the public sector. As soon as there's a hint of job losses, the minister comes in and says, fuck you. And then the board resigns and they start again. There's no hope in hell Eskom's going to be working, profitable, and viable anyway.
I mean, this was, I actually responded, I think it was to Mark Schussler last week, who posted one of those infographics. Someone's finally taken this. I actually tweeted about this more than a year ago, where I compared the number of employees Eskom had and the power generation about a decade ago and now. And essentially, it's the exact same power generation from a decade ago with almost double the employees.
Yep.
And, you know, it's now someone's made this into an infographic, and there's a bit more information there about, like, how many power stations they're running and other things like that. But what you see is output is either the same or slightly down, and money that they require, so money in loans, money being paid out by the organization, not money gotten in, and their employees have all grown. And, you know, Mike was saying, you know, this is terrible and this is inefficient and this is, we need to fix. And my point is that they have achieved their goal. Like, you think that the goal is efficiency and to run things properly. The goal is not efficiency and to run things properly. People look at SAA and they go, oh, well, SAA employs 8 more staff per flight than any other airline on the planet, right? And you're like, yes, that's the goal. The goal, it's socialism, guys. The goal is you give as many people jobs as possible, you redistribute, okay? Give as many people jobs as possible, even if it can't be afforded, and even if they can't sort of rise to those jobs. You borrow as much money as you can to, inverted commas, redistribute the wealth. And so this is part of the plan. This is, you see SAA as a failure. You see ESCOM and that output and that expenditure as a failure. That's not a failure. If you are an ardent socialist, if you are Rob Davies, you have achieved success. Rob Davies is opening up a bottle of champagne this Christmas because he looks at those numbers at SAA and ESCOM and everywhere else, and he goes, mission accomplished. That's Rob Davies' house is a very shitty looking Christmas tree, and a banner like George Bush had on that Air Force, that aircraft carrier, that says mission accomplished, in, except not red, white, and blue, in black, yellow, and green. Like, it's as simple as that. And so I think the sooner people start to understand that, the better. And I suppose this all leads to the decay you talk about and people trying to make their own plans.
Right. I mean, and it's inevitable. ESCOM is, if you're an ANC member, ESCOM is not there to provide electricity at an affordable rate for the country. It's a piggy bank.
Yeah.
Now, how can I use ESCOM to make money for myself? Oh, I'll build a fictitious company and I'll be the middleman between the ESCOM and the coal mines and things like that. It's a piggy bank. Imagine you were given access to billions and billions and billions of rands.
It's not even just access to the billions. It's the ongoing nature of it. We're going to give you an organization where guaranteed every month 5 million people pay you an amount between 100 and 100,000 rand. Like,
and any loan you take will be guaranteed by the state.
Yeah.
Now, people, just listen. These are not companies in the same way Discovery or Toyota or ExxonMobil are companies. They don't care about profit. They don't care about efficiency. They don't care about costs.
And they don't care about the end user either.
They don't care about the customers either. The incentives of SOEs are so perverse. These are not companies. Just think of them as an extension of the Department of Trade and Industry, or the extension of any government department.
Expropriation without constant compensation of your wallet. That's what they are.
That's exactly what they are. They are not companies. Don't lump them together with companies. We have problems with corporates. As Jonathan and I, we have lots of problems with corporates, but these are not even in the same paradigm, same universe, as any corporates on the JSE. They are just there to be, it's a piggy bank. It's a piggy bank. People call it a job to get coal from this place to the next. They know it's more efficient to use the private sector. They know that monopolies are inherently inefficient and will collapse. They know all that, and they just don't care. Because why? Ideology trumps every single time. And the sooner you get that, the sooner you're able to make decisions where you won't need these monopolies in your day-to-day lives. Because these things will collapse, and they are collapsing right now as we speak. And it's not by accident, And it's not because the job is hard. It's not because of the global economy. No, it's because people wanted them to do it. People wanted them to fail. People stole everything from the beginning. And after 24 years, it just cannot be sustained anymore.
Yeah. And now we're down a hole. You would have to ask if it's, I mean, if you're a Helen Ziller, an ardent Helen Ziller follower, and, you know, Helen will say the capable state, you know, Helen will tell you, yes, Jonathan, but what we can do is if you vote the DA, I can't do a voice. I need to get Gareth on the show. If you vote the DA into power, the DA will have be a capable state, and we will sort this out. I'm not sure you can get Eskom out of a 400 billion rand hole. I don't think that that's actually doable. No. It's about a third of our annual GDP. It's just unbelievable. And then if you add, you know, it's not just Eskom then. You add SAA, you add Transnet, you add Prasa.
There's 750 SOEs.
Yeah. You add all of these SOEs onto it, and even if the losses are small, 750 times losses of, let's say, 10 million each, you know, that would be 750 million, and let's be honest, it's probably far more than that. So
it's in the trillions of rands.
Absolutely. So I'm not sure we're in a hole that you can get out of.
Yeah, I mean, what the DA says and what they do is different. So now they actually went to court for a very good thing. They want cities to be able to contract with independent power providers on their own without going through Eskom.
Yeah.
And that sounds to me like secession's on the way. It goes back to the accountability at a city level, own power generation, own water generation. I think day zero has been a godsend to Cape Town. Because now they're going to be like, cool, we need fucking desalination plants. We need our own water. We can't rely on the ANC government to do it.
Which it was obvious, but thank God they realized it.
Thank God they realized it.
Watch. Inverted commas,
Western Cape secession is going. It's on the way. That's exactly what's happening right now. The DA won't be the ones to do it. Whoever takes over from them, we'll see.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that. But let's talk a little bit about
Johann Rupert.
Okay, let's talk about you. I want to talk about your homeland, but fine, let's talk about Johann Rupert first. Johann Rupert goes on ENCA. I really wish he would come on the show. We have invited him. I understand, obviously, no decision made by that guy and his advisors would be a flippant sort of, yeah, I'll come on your show.
And certainly not from a few tweets from the Renegade Report, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I'll go.
Yeah, these guys sound reasonable. Just optics, for example, would be looked at, and they'd go, no, he can't go on that show because of optics, for example.
Jonathan, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt. He doesn't know we fucking exist.
Truthfully, yes, but even if he did, I still think there would be all those kinds of issues. But he goes on ENCA. There's an interview. I've seen bits and pieces. I can't say I've watched the whole thing. Just not my vibe, because for me, it's always going to be slightly scripted.
Well, of course.
And it's always going to, you know, be controlled. And I hate conversations like that. It's why I enjoy doing the podcast. But look, he says really reasonable things. The most controversial of which, perhaps, I'm not your father Christmas, right?
Quote of the year. But for me, it's an interesting interview, because I think it's sort of the litmus test, in a way, of what can be said on a public platform that is watched by many, that makes the news, and that trends on Twitter, right? So if we are niche. We're still a niche podcast. We do very well, but we're still niche, right? Johann Rupert says 60% of what we say on a much bigger platform gets reported all over the country. And despite what everyone says, the overwhelming reaction is praise. If you look, I don't care about what the columnists said.
Yeah,
about,
I was just going to say. A lot of the
Johann
columnists
Rupert gets nailed.
Typical white man saying, typical white rich man.
Bullshit like that. If you look at the comments, you look at what people have written about it, you look at, I saw a lot of Facebook posts by people that I assume are black, all anecdotal, but overwhelmingly they say, what has he said? What does he say? That's weird.
Pushing personal responsibility, a lot of what he said.
Right. He didn't mention race. He's trying to talk about time preference, which is a very ordinary economic
basic term
that says do you have a high or low time preference? If you have a high time preference, you consume and you spend very quickly. Low time preference, you save for the long term and you get the rewards at the end of the day. That's all he's talking about. And he says millennials have this problem where they spend and consume far too quickly, whereas our parents did otherwise. And that is observably true.
Yep.
Through savings rates, if you look back before credit cards, people used to save like crazy. My grandparents still save even though they're very wealthy. My domestic worker is 60 years old, Maria. She's got more money in her bank account than I do. And she earns far less than I do. So there has been a shift. But what is interesting about Johann Rupert is the manner he says it. He's still an Afrikaner from the Cape. And he speaks about the Shangaan and the blacks and this. And every time he said the blacks, the guy said, no, it's black people. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, black people and white people. He mocked it. And he said, I forget that I'm living in the snowflake generation. But the litmus test of that interview was a very successful man that does not need to be in this country at all, still chooses to be here. And he says, no matter what I do, the rules change halfway through a deal. I try to build a farm, I try to build a mill, I try to build a dam. The DTI agrees with me, I build it. Then the rules change. Then I'm screwed. Why would I want to stay here? Why would I want to help anyone here? And people called him out, said, oh, but you're rich and you don't give out. He says, I know what I am. I know I'm not a racist. I know who I am.
Yeah.
You calling me that means nothing to me.
Yeah.
I share much more than I use for myself. Your words mean absolutely nothing to me. Mm. And that sort of attitude, which is mine too, because I know who I am, and okay, words hurt, and I don't have his money, unfortunately. But that sort of attitude was so refreshing, and I think to a lot of people, how do you explain? Humanized, that's the word. It humanized him. And he speaks, I think Johann Rupert speaks for a large minority of people in this country that I've never heard. And that's why it was such
a... You think it's a minority?
Well, I don't think people think deeply about what they believe.
No, I don't. But I do think if you were to force people to drill down, I think it's a majority. I think the majority of people embrace their responsibilities in life. Obviously, we've got all kinds of issues with people not embracing responsibility. Fatherless homes, for example, and people who are unemployed who are able to work, but there are barriers to them and all those types of things. But certainly, we've got problems with people not taking responsibility. But we do have tens of millions of people who every day they wake up, they work hard, doing jobs they maybe don't love, but they do them because they put food on the table at home. They pay their bills as best they can. They do take personal responsibility. That's what I got from most of what I saw of the interview. I just got this sense of a guy who goes, like, just be personally responsible. I didn't get – he doesn't say it the same way Jordan Peterson says it, right?
Yeah.
And he doesn't say it the same way Rogan will say it. And he doesn't say it – in some respects, even the same way Trump will say it. But I still get the same essential message, right? Like, just take responsibility. Clean your room. Like, yeah. Take responsibility for yourself.
It's a marathon.
I'm not here to, like, protect you from the world and to save you from yourself or the harsh realities of life. It's not perfect, and it never will be. And, like, sort your shit out.
Yeah, it starts with you.
You know,
it starts with you. And he says, it's a 30-year journey to get somewhere. It's a 30-year process, a 40-year process, a lifetime perhaps.
Yeah.
To get somewhere. No, I think it was the interview was shocking, but the interview was very important, and I think it hopefully leads to more of these ideas being circulated in the public sphere. And Mr. Rupert, if you are listening, Dr. Rupert, sorry, if you are listening, or your son perhaps, we would love to have you in our humble studio here at Cliff Central.
Or we will happily take an invite to your estate in Stellenbosch.
Private jet to Switzerland just for the interview. You know, I mean, if it has to be done, it has to be done. I'll go to the end of the earth.
Mont Blanc pens and Cartier watches as obvious just gifts for the visit.
But on a related note, it must be so shit to be that wealthy. Because what do you buy people? Like, everyone's got...
What do you buy your friends?
Yeah, everyone's got everything. Like, at birthdays,
what do you buy a billionaire?
Do you buy him an island? Like, it must be tough.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. I suppose you start dealing at higher stakes. You know, this is where we see the sort of elites making political deals and, I suppose, chasing power in some respects. He hasn't done that.
Yeah.
But
what was interesting, though, Anton Rupert, his father, was the candidate for the NP to go against Verwoerd.
Yeah.
He was, so Anton was not he was already wealthy, but he was not a politician. The NP, some elements of it, wanted to bring him in to be the moderate opponent of Verwoerd. Unfortunately, he lost. There was some reason that he couldn't actually run.
Quite a different country it would be.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Let's talk quickly global stuff. It's been quite the year, and let's start with what's happening in France at the moment, a little bit in the Netherlands as well. So you've got, I think you posted an interesting image of quite a wide variety of people protesting against what is Emmanuel Macron's government. You know, you've got socialists in that bunch. You've got anarcho-capitalists. You've got fascists, it would seem. So you've kind of got the full mix of political ideologies. Except for whatever Emmanuel Macron is.
Globalist.
Which is, elitist globalist, I suppose. And essentially, as far as I can tell, what's gone on in France is that the populace has been taxed to death. And because France is quite a large populace, it is not homogenous by any means, really, anymore. In saying that it's not just like sort of French people in the countryside making cheese and bread. So there's it is quite multicultural, inverted commas. So you don't have the sort of Denmark-Norway model, but they have tried to run this sort of democratic socialist state where the government taxes you a lot of money, and in return you supposedly get a whole bunch of services. And it seems that it's got to a breaking point where people are getting taxed so hard that they actually have very little to actually live. Is that fair?
It's actually a little bit simpler than that. So in France, petrol and diesel, there was always a massive price difference between the two.
Yeah.
So in the 70s and 80s, the eco-mentalist was like, diesel, you know, petrol is a big contributed CO2, whereas diesel isn't. So they put a lot of, I don't know why, they put a lot of taxes on petrol.
Yeah.
And fewer taxes on diesel.
As it turns out, NOx is way worse, but anyway.
Right. And now, I don't know if this is true, but the Paris Agreement sort of says that we need to increase taxes on fossil fuels.
For first world countries, it does.
Right. So they want to increase the tax on diesel to make it the same as petrol, the same price. Unfortunately, you got 30 years of people buying diesel cars because it was a cheaper option, because, you know, people understand.
And the working class, I'm assuming.
Mostly, but also transportation, like huge trucks, logistics. It's all diesel. Mm. I think it's 60-70% diesel. French cars are diesel. Yeah. And Europe generally, diesel is much more popular than petrol. So he wanted to raise a tax on that to make it equal to petrol, Macron, that is. And the people weren't having it. That was the first element of the things. So then Macron says, okay, fine, I will take away the tax on diesel. And then they say, no, but we want to be out of the EU, limit immigration.
Yeah, like all these. This was the interviews I saw where people were saying, the problem is you've started the conversation now, basically, and it's not only about diesel anymore. It's about the fact that when I go home at the end of the month, there's not enough money for like what I need to live. Meanwhile, you're taxing the hell out of me and signing agreements to like save the world from climate change.
Yeah, undemocratic agreements.
And like get fucked, basically.
So here's the conundrum, Jonathan, because we called out Fees Must Fall on this. We said, if it was for fees, well, cool, we get you. But then it's about insourcing of workers, then it's about fucking the patriarchy and all this. So we called out the double standards there. And in any protest, there's never one thing. It's a multitude of things that people...
Well, this is the Jason Werbeloff argument, congregate right? Together. There's no such thing as a group.
Right. But assuming there are. People do go to one protest for various things. So with some is the diesel tax, right? But the diesel tax was imposed by the EU. So we are actually anti-EU. Oh, but a lot of taxes are being used on immigrants. So we are anti-immigrants. So all these sort of people come together within one thing to protest. So actually, this might be the first protest which I sort of support in a way.
What? Because it's multifactorial, or because
I think it's real. I think it's based on a reality that people like Macron doesn't understand, because he's still the EU poster boy, the centrist liberal who will say France. Yeah, fuck you. 18% approval rating. Marine Le Pen's at 36% approval rating.
Why can't France get their leadership right? What is it about? Because they do this quite often, though. You know, Macron's failings aside for a second, this happens all the time. If you look at the progression of the presidential candidates, they all start off at around a 50-odd% approval rating, and they all drop off after 3-4 years, and you know. I don't think anyone in recent times has been as bad as 18%, but they're all sitting in the 30s or higher upper 20s.
But that's quite common in Europe.
Yes. Why can't they find a leader that they, you know, like and actually does what's right for them?
Because it's democracy where the worst go to the top. That's hardly a surprise. What is interesting, though, is that the English are not burning stuff in the streets.
Yeah, that was Brendan O'Neill's comment.
Which is very interesting, because Brexit seems like...
Oh, they're subverting democracy. There's no other way to put it.
Except for Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And they want a people's referendum now, which is absolute bullshit.
Which is hilarious, because what was the first thing? You notice how there were people, about, I think, 18 million of them, who voted for Brexit.
The biggest vote in British history.
Yeah.
More people voted in that than in the general election.
Yeah.
And now Brexit's being torn to shit by Theresa May, who we always thought was very weak on this.
Yes.
The only potential is that she gets axed and they leave with no deal whatsoever. And Jacob Rees-Mogg meets with Donald Trump and they get some great deals going through that way once he becomes PM. But Europe is not in a good spot. And a very good book to read about this, I think I might have mentioned this here, is National Populism, The Revolt Against Democracy by Matthew Goodwin. It explains what national populism is and how it arises. And it's a phenomenal book. And I think national populism is here to stay, because it's about more democracy, not less.
Yeah.
Despite what everyone else, it's not about Nazism or fascism, it's about having more democracy.
Yeah, because what's happened over time is that the political class has become its own ruling elite, completely disconnected from the average voter. And so the average voter is rebelling against that.
Yes, absolutely. But it's about the ability to change your country in the way that you want to change it under the normal democratic mechanisms that have always worked before.
Mm.
And that has been taken away, has been eroded very slowly over since the 1970s. And now people are rightfully pissed off about it and rightfully angry that these agreements that they don't agree with, that they've never seen in their whole life, is determining why their fuel is so high or so expensive.
Yeah.
So that's the conundrum that national populism tries to solve. And if you look at Salvini in Italy, the Hungarian chap, I forgot his name, and the one in Austria, and in Spain now, the right wing just won, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. National populism is back with a huge vengeance, and I can't speak for the future, but I hope it leads to more democracy, more accountability, more transparency than before. But power tends to corrupt, absolutely, so we'll see.
Yeah, and there are some dangerous figures in that group. Lastly, I just want to talk. We need to finish soon, but I want to talk quickly about Donald Trump because it's kind of an interesting. We basically next year is just going to be election stuff. From pretty much April, May, they're going to start for the 2020 elections. They're going to primaries will only be the following year, but they're all going to start launching their campaigns. To give you context, if this was just before the 2016 elections, it would have been June of this coming year that Donald Trump would have said, I'm running. So that's the year we're entering.
18 months before.
And remember, he entered the race late when there are already like 11 or 12 people in the Republican side. So just on it, there's a couple of things I find quite interesting about what's happening in the U.S. One is the repeated bombshells that don't seem to do anything. So you keep having these bombshells about how this happened to Trump or his lawyer is testifying for the FBI. I think it's going to be very interesting what this Mueller report is going to come out soon. And I don't think it's going to be what either side expects, frankly. So I think that'll be quite interesting. And I don't think Donald Trump's going anywhere unless the economy tanks. He has fiddled a little bit with that because of his trade shit, which we've spoken about on the show and we don't really agree with. But I wondered if you had any reflective points on it, because the guy's been in office for essentially more than 2.5 years now. It's 2 years in January. So it's 2 years. The fear-mongering certainly hasn't happened. It hasn't stopped, but, almost everything that was said has not occurred. Do you think we're getting to a normalization a little bit where people are like, okay, fine, we hate him, but like he's not literally Hitler and he hasn't set up those concentration camps for gay people and Mike Pence isn't literally electrocuting gay people in the street and women aren't in The Handmaid's Tale, although the Christmas trees in the White House were epic. Red Christmas trees with Melania Trump and someone photoshopped The Handmaid's Tale outfit on it, which is great. But do you think like things are starting to like get a little bit more normal where people are like, okay, fine, he's the president we hate. End of story.
I hope not. I hope there's deeper polarization going forward. No, polarization is really important in a democracy, especially a strong one like the US. No, I just think they're sort of getting used to how he behaves. Like now he called out.
It's not so shocking.
He called out Rex Tillerson for being a loser and he was the terrible secretary.
I think he said he was moronic.
Something like that.
Dumb as a rock. Dumb as a rock was what he said. But remember, Rex had previously said Donald Trump was the biggest idiot he'd ever met or something like that.
Right. But Donald Trump was his boss and he appointed Rex Tillerson. So it tells you a little bit more about the chaotic nature of Trump. And if America is America Inc. and Trump is the CEO, you fire lots of people in companies. They keep coming in and out. It's normal that this sort of stuff happens. I think Trump has had a particularly good year. I think the North-South Korea thing, it seems to bear some fruition. I think the migrant caravan thing worked out in his favor.
He killed ISIS.
That was last mostly. Year. That was last year. And that was mostly Iraq, if we're really honest, rather than that. Syria's out of the news completely. No one talks about Syria anymore.
Well, there haven't been major terrorist attacks this year for the most part.
Yeah, that's true.
Remember, we had major terrorist attacks for a long time, shootings in major cities, terrorist attacks in major tourist locations. And that has really, really, to a large extent, I'm not saying it's gone, but at the rate it was happening, it's really disappeared.
And I found that I think China blinked with the trade war stuff. They really have. So he's won the first hurdle. Donald Trump is a tariff guy.
He said he's tariff man.
Tariff man, right? The worst superhero since I don't know who. Since Venom. If you want to watch the worst movie of the year, watch Venom.
Rubbish. Venom was highly enjoyable. Don't listen to the movie.
Tom Hardy. No, it's absolute shit.
Absolutely enjoyable.
That is a blight on Donald Trump's presidency that a movie like that could be released during his tenure. But I think he's had quite a good year. And I listen to a lot of American podcasts about the media and Donald Trump and all that. I want them to fight, man. I want them to fight. I think it's good for democracy to fight. As I said, when you first got elected, I support Donald Trump for two reasons. One, he's effective. And number two, hopefully, people will become suspicious of executive power. And they have been, but only in the last 2 years. And they keep falling over themselves when they put kids in cages and the pictures from like 2014. That's under like Obama, right? It's like, oh shit, I didn't know. Well, there you go. Yeah. It points out the blindness to reporting. You only report when you don't like the person, as opposed to reporting on principle. So I hope that polarization carries on.
Well, then let's hope he wins 2020 if he wants it to carry on.
Yeah, I think it's important important for democracy.
I wonder. I mean, yeah. The guy's been insane. I say that loosely, but I know you need to go. We'll wrap it up now. But just to say that he's been like no other U.S. president, put it that way. Certainly in his public profile, his tweets, the way he talks, the way he reacts to things, the way he goes about his job, he has been definitely completely different. And I wonder what a Trump in a second term who doesn't need to win re-election would be like. I wonder what that unleashes. I don't think it unleashes the fascists, and I know that that's what the screaming is going to be about. But I'm interested to know, you know, from a governmental perspective, in terms of the policy he's done, he's been very conservative. Most conservatives in America will tell you he's been more conservative than anyone they've had in the modern era, including Reagan.
And he's racked up a trillion dollar debt. So yeah. He's very Republican in that way.
So the point is the policy that he's pushed through has been very conservative. Be interesting to see where that goes. I'd just be interested to see a second term, but yeah.
But I think Democratic states are turning to strong men. So we had technocrats before.
Yeah.
Now we've got strong men coming, a la Putin. But
it's because you're misogynist. There are no strong women.
Well, the strong woman, the Croatian one, is very strong. The president, but we are voting in personalities more than technocrats or things like that. So Obama was a personality, so is Trump. But if you look at, once again, the national populist stuff, the Salvinis, the Bolsonaros, I keep forgetting the one in Hungary and the one in Austria. We looking at a strong man democracy where this person encapsulates what we want from a leader. Not because he's the most intelligent or the most...
Orban, I think. Viktor Orban.
Yes, Orban. And he's a bastard of note, Orban. Mm. But not because they're eloquent or they speak well or they're manicured or the most intelligent person. They're sort of what, when we envision someone taking charge, we're looking at that bull in the china shop thing. And that's going to be a very interesting next couple of years. I think it's going to stay for a while.
Mm.
We're going to get the candidate that we want to be leader because they have leadership qualities, not because they're the best or the most eloquent. And that's going to be a new way of looking at them.
And they want to do a certain thing and they're prepared to stick to that. They don't care if it's unpopular, especially outside of their country. You know, because that's been a thing. Like, yeah. I mean, this is the problem.
The UN says we can't do this.
The UN says, or the EU says,
the
citizens of the country going, we don't give a shit. That's best for us.
Yeah.
And you're in charge of us, not you don't do for what's good for the world.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that's the end of the show for the year.
And it's been a phenomenal year for us.
Yes.
To be honest, I think we've grown massively. We've grown over 100% this year, based on the downloads we saw. And that's possible, because we are brilliant. And because, most importantly, because our listeners tune in and share with friends and family and enemies and everyone else who they share with.
And all over the world. We got an email over the weekend from Simon in the UK telling us that loves what we're doing and has been sharing our podcast with family and friends.
Yeah, I got some from Saudi Arabia, from Alaska. Well, the guy from Alaska came to live here.
Yeah, he did.
After listening to us. So we just want to say thank you to everyone who listens to us. We hope you find it useful. We hope that we're able to articulate points that you won't hear elsewhere, not because they're weird or controversial, but because people don't really understand what's going on, and we hope we give you a fuller picture of what's going on locally and internationally. And next year's a big year for us. We're turning 3, and you know, when you are 3, you start to not walk and you start to run, and we've got a lot of plans in the pipeline. Hopefully make this a lot bigger, a lot better, to please you and to fight the battle of ideas on your behalf. We are very happy to do that.
Awesome. And from my side, thank you very much for your support over the year. Thank you for listening. We'd be speaking to no one if it wasn't for your downloads. We really do appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who's given feedback over the year. We appreciate that as well, and we do take it on board, provided it's not completely useless.
And we understand we're not perfect by any means. Yeah. We do fuck up sometimes. Sometimes the show is not good. Sometimes, you know, these sort of things happen. We try to maintain the standard. And if you're honest with us, we appreciate that tremendously.
Absolutely. And as always, if you enjoy the show and you'd like to contribute something towards its ongoing health, we are for the moment on Patreon. We will look at other options, but you can find us on Patreon, Renegade Report, there. You can always follow us on the different social media apps. So you're on Instagram, you're on Twitter, Renegade_Report, on Facebook, a page and a group. The group is where we have sort of discussions about various things. And as always, Ramon at Roman Kabanak, myself at Jonathan_Witt. Thank you so much for an excellent 2018. We will see you mid-January 2019. As always, cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.